India and the United States will always be tied together in friendship and respect.
President Donald Trump meets with India's Prime Minister Modi. It's Tuesday, June 27th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm David Byrd in Washington. You know, you're part of this program. Join us on any of our VOA Asia social media platforms. Also ahead, China gives dissident Liu Xiaobo medical parole. Takata files for bankruptcy over an airbag scandal. And Papua New Guinea begins its election process. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Indian Prime Minister Modi and President Donald Trump just concluded a meeting at the White House for the first time since Trump took office. In a Rose Garden statement, the president said the relationship between India and the United States has never been stronger or better.
India has the fastest growing economy in the world. We hope we're going to be catching you very soon in terms of percentage increase. I have to tell you that. We're working on it. In just 2 weeks, you will begin to implement the largest tax overhaul in your country's history. We're doing that also, by the way, creating great new opportunities for your citizens. You have a big vision for improving infrastructure, and you are fighting government corruption, which is always a grave threat to democracy. Together, our countries can help chart an optimistic path into the future, one that unleashes the power of new technology, new infrastructure, and the enthusiasm and excitement of very hardworking and very dynamic people.
The president praised India's cooperation in fighting terrorism, and he thanked the Indian people for their help in the war in Afghanistan. He also criticized North Korea for its recent threats.
Both our nations have been struck by the evils of terrorism, and we are both determined to destroy terrorist organizations and the radical ideology that drives them. We will destroy radical Islamic terrorism. Our militaries are working every day to enhance cooperation between our military forces, and next month they will join together with the Japanese Navy to take part in the largest maritime exercise ever conducted in the vast Indian Ocean. I also thank the Indian people for their contributions to the effort in Afghanistan and for joining us in applying new sanctions against the North Korean regime. The North Korean regime is causing tremendous problems, and it's something that has to be dealt with, and probably dealt with rapidly. Working together, I truly believe our two countries can set an example for many other nations, make great strides in defeating common threats, and make great progress in unleashing amazing prosperity and growth.
President Trump said he looked forward to working with the Prime Minister on a series of issues. For some perspective on the U.S.-India relationship, VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Rafiq Dosani, a RAND Corporation South Asia analyst. Dosani told Beatty that both countries stand to benefit from a stronger relationship.
When Mr. Modi says the ease of doing business has improved, he primarily refers to the ease of doing business within India. There's now a general services tax, for example, which is a value-added tax that's going to replace over the next several months separate taxes in each state. Now, this is going to make a big difference in the ease of doing business in India. However, if one considers the ease of doing business for foreign companies, particularly with regard to trade, India still has significant non-tariff and tariff barriers to trade.
The Trump administration has authorized the sale of some 22 Guardian MQ-9B unmanned surveillance drones for India to use. Is this a sign of deepening defense ties?
This is a deal that's been in the making for a while. I think the timing has been arranged so that it shows that Mr. Trump can tell his domestic political clientele that, look, you know, people are buying American goods, countries like India, and so that's one side of it. On the other side, Mr. Modi is keen to signal that the special relationship with the United States is strong, and he wants it to continue at a level that it was in the Obama administration or even better. So I think that's what's behind it. It's symbolic on both sides.
What are the other issues that Mr. Modi would like to come away with on a positive note?
The strategic issues of terrorism, the issue of investment and jobs, which means that, you know, buying defense equipment from the United States, buying U.S. technology, all of these create jobs in India. The very open atmosphere that India has for American services, banking, unlike the rest of Asia, particularly Southeast Asia and East Asia, and big countries like Japan and Korea and China, you know, in India, American services like Google and Facebook have captured the market.
Rafiq Dosani is a South Asia analyst with the RAND Corporation. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. These are among the top Asia stories trending now on voanews.com. China's Nobel Peace Prize laureate released from prison. U.S. to declare China as among world's worst human trafficking offenders. Funerals begin for Pakistan tanker fire victims. Marathon election starts in Papua New Guinea. And New Zealand law student Chen launches climate change court case. You can find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia now continues. Noted Chinese dissident and Nobel Peace Prize winner Liu Xiaobo has been released from prison on a medical parole. He was diagnosed, that is, with late-stage liver cancer last month and is being treated at a hospital in the northeastern city of Shenyang. The 61-year-old Liu was sentenced to 11 years in prison in 2009 for advocating democracy in China. In 2010, the Norway-based Nobel Committee awarded him the Peace Prize for his long and nonviolent struggle for fundamental human rights in China. The recognition from the committee infuriated the Chinese government. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with William Ni, a China researcher with Amnesty International, about Liu's case and what the Chinese government needs to do to improve human rights.
What kind of effect will this release and his condition mean for the Chinese government lying ahead?
Well, I think the most important thing is that they need to do their utmost to ensure that he gets adequate medical treatment. And if it's true that they have assigned 8 specialists to him, then that could be actually a good sign. But, you know, they need to release him unconditionally. If he desires to go abroad for medical treatment, that might be a good option. Now, they've kept his wife, Liu Xia, under house arrest ever since he was detained. So, obviously, they need to stop that house arrest and harassment of her and let her reunite with her husband. And in a broader sense, they should release all political prisoners like Liu Xiaobo who have been imprisoned for nothing more than exercising their human rights. And this will be a very important sign or a very important case to watch over the summer and going into the so-called 19th Party Congress, which is the next big event in the Chinese political calendar coming up later this year.
Well, as we know, the leader of China, Xi Jinping, has been very tough on political dissidents. Do you expect to see any change there?
Well, no. Unfortunately, we've seen a crackdown on human rights activists, on lawyers, on ethnic minorities, on Christians, Buddhists, Muslims. So the overall trend doesn't look good, but perhaps I'm not exactly hopeful. But I think this could be a renewed opportunity for the government to take a new path and, you know, in the end, ensure that they are fulfilling their human rights obligations, but also win greater global prestige and even domestic legitimacy by doing so.
That's William Ni of Amnesty International. He was speaking with VOA's Ira Melman. Happening in Asia, China's President Xi Jinping met separately with the prime ministers of Sweden and Finland on Monday. Both European leaders are in China to attend a conference of the World Economic Forum. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us here on VOA Asia. Voting has begun in Papua New Guinea's marathon national elections, with a prime minister facing an arrest warrant for corruption. Peter O'Neill's People's National Congress won the last poll in 2012, but critics are accusing him of burying the nation's economy in debt. As Phil Mercer reports from Sydney, final results in the country of 7 million are not expected until late next month.
About 5 million voters will elect members of Papua New Guinea's 111-seat parliament. Occupying the eastern half of the island of New Guinea and numerous islands, PNG is a land of rugged terrain, and voting will last for 2 weeks. Many voters will have to walk for hours to cast their ballot. A final result isn't expected until late July. Opponents of Prime Minister O'Neill say he's caused economic collapse in a country with rich natural resources that has been hit by falling global commodity prices. PNG has high levels of unemployment, crime and poverty. O'Neill, who steadfastly denied allegations of corruption, has resisted months of protests and civil disobedience, urging him to resign. He survived a parliamentary no-confidence vote last year. He's told Australian television that he has nothing to hide.
I am not above the law. I am quite happy to go to courts like anyone else. And I've proven time and time again that those allegations are not true and have been politically motivated in many cases. The ballot will speak for itself. So all the things that we have listed down, we have achieved well over 90% of it. For any government, that is a high achievement. It's been never been done before.
Mineral deposits, including copper, gold and oil, make up almost two-thirds of PNG's export earnings. There are also huge reserves of natural gas, but the exploitation of these resources has been hindered by rugged terrain and land rights issues. Villagers often complain that they've yet to receive royalty payments from large resource projects. A record number of women are standing in the election. No party has ever won a majority, so another coalition government appears likely. Papua New Guinea, a former Australian colony, is a member of the Commonwealth grouping of former British colonies. Australia is PNG's largest aid donor and has been working alongside electoral authorities to ensure the election goes smoothly, while more than 10,000 police and other personnel have been deployed to maintain security. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And you're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
You're listening to VOA Asia. I'm David Byrd in Washington. South Korean Foreign Minister Kang Kyung-hwa said Monday that Seoul has no intention of reversing its agreement with the United States over the deployment of the missile defense system known as THAAD to the Korean Peninsula. Speaking at a forum in Seoul, Minister Kang said Seoul has no plans to reverse deployment of that system, but is making sure that all procedures are followed to ensure public support.
My government has no intention to basically reverse the commitments made in the spirit of the ROK-US alliance. Going through the environmental impact assessment is an issue of domestic due process, and it does not mean that we will cancel or reverse the decision to deploy THAAD. With democratic and procedural legitimacy obtained, we will strengthen public support for the deployment, which in turn will further strengthen the alliance into the future.
The foreign minister also denounced North Korea as, in her words, inhumane and cruel following the recent death of American college student Otto Warmbier.
Human rights is a universal value that transcends borders. Every person counts and must be protected against abuses committed in the name of sovereignty. In this regard, my president conveyed his deepest condolences on the tragic death of Mr. Otto Warmbier, and we strongly condemn North Korea's inhuman and cruel treatment of Mr. Warmbier, and our hearts go out to his bereaved family.
Regarding reopening the Kaesong Industrial Park, which the previous administration shut down in February of 2016 following North Korea's missile and nuclear provocations, Kang said that the current government would consider it only under certain circumstances.
As my president mentioned in his recent interviews, we will pursue this only under the right circumstances. In other words, it is something that can be pursued at a later stage when we are assured of progress in dealing with the North Korean nuclear and missile threats. And we will do so in closest consultation with the United States. It is not something we can discuss at this stage when we are ratcheting up sanctions and pressure on Pyongyang.
Minister Kang made the remarks at a forum organized by the U.S. foreign policy think tank, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, along with South Korea's major daily newspaper, Jung-an. This news alert from VOA Asia. Indian security forces on Monday clashed with thousands of anti-India protesters who took to the streets after special Eid al-Fitr prayers in Indian-administrated Kashmir. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Do you have an airbag in your car? Well, embattled Japanese auto parts manufacturer Takata said Monday it has filed for bankruptcy protection after being overwhelmed with the costs of lawsuits and recalls related to its defective airbags. 16 people died from the airbag when igniters shattered and spewed shrapnel into the passenger compartments of cars. The defective airbags led to a global recall of tens of millions of automobiles. The defective devices also caused a public relations scandal for the Japanese company. Matthew Lindley is a professor at Nagoya University. He told VOA that this is the largest such bankruptcy in Japan's post-war history.
I believe it is the biggest bankruptcy for a manufacturer in Japan ever. A few years ago, Panasonic had serious debt, but this is the largest debt for a manufacturing company in Japan.
Takata has already agreed to pay a $1 billion fine to settle with U.S. safety regulators. But Matthew Lindley says the company's slow response to driver and passenger deaths, and many of the deaths happening in the United States, contributed to its demise.
I think that the company also said that they had known about this actually for quite a few years, about the exploding airbags and the shrapnel, because of the ammonia nitrate would degrade after a long time. And the response was very slow, but many of the accidents seem to have happened in the United States. So I think actually that's quite an important part of the story, is that because basically lawsuits are more common in the U.S. and the fact that there were quite a few people in the United States who were willing to sue Takata, that really, I think, got the ball rolling on this story. On the news this morning as well, too, they went out to the factory in Kyushu, one of their largest factory where they do the seatbelts and the airbags. And they tried to get interviews with many of the employees, but the employees, some of them have said they have not heard anything. And the Japanese government doesn't seem to be, they're not talking about a bailout or anything like that, but they seem to be quite concerned about the impact that Takada's bankruptcy will have on other small and medium-sized firms, because obviously there's going to be a knock-on effect on other companies that rely on Takata airbags.
A Detroit-based Chinese open-owned company, that is, Key Safety Systems, will take over Takata's assets and operations for $1.5 billion. Matthew Lindley says some Japanese are concerned about losing such a large company.
So this is actually getting quite a bit of attention in the Japanese media. So I was going through some of the stories, and all of them mention that KSS, the umbrella company, is Chinese. I mean, no one is saying it directly, but I guess there is a kind of concern that a very, very large and important Japanese company may be coming under control of a Chinese company.
Matthew Lindley is a professor at Nagoya University in Japan. The Tokyo Stock Exchange suspended trading of Takata shares on Monday and said it would delist the company on Tuesday. For those that are seeking damages from Takata, they will have to go through the bankruptcy courts, which could take years. Those seeking replacement of defective airbags will also have to wait. Developing at this hour in Asia, Australian and Chinese employees of a casino company on Monday pleaded guilty to charges related to gambling, with the three Australians sentenced to 9 or 10 months imprisonment. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia, Twitter, and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Scientists sometimes prefer to forests as carbon sinks. That means they absorb a lot of planet-warming carbon dioxide. But as VOA's Kevin Enox tells us, researchers at the University of Birmingham are trying to find out just how good forests are at storing carbon and if there is a limit on how much they can absorb.
These metal circles are part of an experiment to test just how good forests are at fighting climate change. Each of these pipes is dotted with holes that are pumping carbon dioxide directly into this English forest.
We have 6 such arrays, 3 that will pump CO2 and 3 that are so-called controls. It means they leave the forest undisturbed except for all the building work.
The pipes are pumping the same amount of carbon into the forest that could be entering the Earth's atmosphere in 2050. The goal is to understand how forests absorb carbon and if there's a limit to how much they can handle.
What we don't know, however, is, first of all, how forests did that and why, where that CO2 goes exactly, and how long forests could keep doing that.
The experiment is expected to last a decade and will focus not only on the trees in this forest, but also how its soil and insects react to higher CO2 levels. Kevin Enox, VOA News.
Many people think of measles as a childhood disease, but as VOA's Carol Pearson tells us now, it could be much more dangerous than that.
Many people think measles is just another childhood disease, a rash, a fever, and it's gone. But top doctors say otherwise.
Measles is not a trivial disease. If you have a measles outbreak, a proportion of people are going to have serious complications.
Measles can cause permanent brain damage. It can leave a child blind or deaf. Measles also kills.
In the pre-vaccine era, before we had the measles outbreaks, we had about 500 kids die every year of measles in the U.S. and 50,000 hospitalizations.
Most people get better within 2 weeks, but the effects can linger.
If a child acquires measles, even in a country like the United States, he can have complication of measles that can be deadly, like pneumonia, or he can have like a reduction in his immune functions. He can also have malnutrition for quite some time after. So the child becomes weaker and more susceptible to other infections.
All it takes is a sneeze or a cough to spread the virus in tiny droplets through the air. One person can affect up to 18 others. Each one of those people infects another dozen or so, and it spreads from there. 90% of those exposed will get the virus unless they've been vaccinated or have already had measles. The measles virus can linger on doorknobs, tables, any surface for up to 2 hours. Touch it and you're exposed.
It's incredibly contagious. And the kids who get measles are really, really sick. I mean, it's a pretty big deal to get measles.
The first signs of measles are a runny nose, cough, and a fever followed by a red rash. Measles is not just a childhood disease. Adults can get it too. The American Academy of Pediatrics has asked doctors to work with parents who are reluctant to get their children vaccinated. Dr. Hope Scott at Reston Town Center Pediatrics in Virginia says her practice will allow parents to set up a delayed vaccine schedule to a point.
We'll work with them probably till about age 2 or so. And if they've not vaccinated by then and don't have a plan to do it and aren't acting on the plan, we will at that point ask them to leave the practice.
The single best way to prevent measles is to get 2 doses of the measles vaccine. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends children get the first dose after their first birthday and the second when they are between 4 and 6 years old. The 2 doses together provide 97% protection against measles. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Thanks for being with us. Find us on Facebook and email us at voaasia@voanews.com. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Enjoy your day.